I heard three times today to come back to the body. I don't get this. Can you explain? Well, there is something below the neck. It's good to sort of check into it from time to time. So it's a way of anchoring awareness and mindfulness, having a tangible ground to establish attention and awareness. Otherwise, attention and awareness often becomes nebulous and diffuse. If that's the case, then it's hard to gain a real clarity. By establishing mindfulness, coming back to the body, having an anchor, then it helps to provide a mirror for thoughts, feelings, and the way that the mind moves and works. So it's a very helpful foundation for developing awareness. Okay. On reflecting this Thanksgiving Day, I see that an infinite number of actions, possibilities, chances, intentions, karma, events, etc., have led me to this very extraordinary time being with this Sangha embraced by the Dhamma. I feel rivers of gratitude to all who played a part. Oh, and my question is, isn't that Hitesi just the sweetest angel? Yes, in a word. This is for Ajahn Khrunadamo.
Dear Ajahn Khrunadamo, are you a mind reader? No. I can answer that one very easily. You spoke to exactly what my brain has been doing the past day and a half. Your suggestion was very helpful. However, sometimes when I look to the body, there is no emotional push there. Is there always an emotional push to a thought? What other things can I look for? Thanks for your on-the-spot talk. I guess I wouldn't say that there's always a strong, noticeable, at least in my experience, a strong, noticeable emotional push to every thought that we have. Some thoughts are pretty just mundane and neutral. I find that often when there's kind of a proliferation or a train of thought that's going on that seems to keep continuing, that there is something below that that's feeding it. It's not just sort of a neutral ongoing experience. There's, even if it's subtle, there's something that just keeps that train moving, even if it's just maybe like a very mild kind of underlying, almost ever-present state of like, it's like a little state of anxiety, because usually what's happening with the proliferative mind is that it's constantly churning out ideas or thoughts to try and answer a question or resolve a problem, and usually when there's something like that going on, then there is something underneath it that's more of an underlying tendency. You know, it could be something that's as coarse, quote unquote, like anger or aversion or out and out desire, lust, or it could be just something that's very, very subtle, just like a kind of an underlying tendency towards fear or anxiety that just is looking for a way in the conceptual world to find an answer and justify its existence and cure it. And so that this kind of mental process keeps happening because it's being fed by even something very subtle. So I just find it's always very useful to keep on coming back to that what's beneath this, what's underneath this, just set the thoughts, the concepts aside, because there's no end to the searching for an answer in externals. Only when I can really feel that and touch the base of what's underneath it do things start to subside. You know, if you're really quiet, and things are pretty still on a feeling level or an emotional level, you can sit there with a very, very peaceful underlying, sense, emotional stability, a very clear, calm thing. And then the mind will just still keep on kind of rattling out words and phrases and who knows, all sorts of weird stuff. And it's just, sort of rattling on. But sometimes, and you can almost see it, it almost feels a little psychotic sometimes what the mind can put out. But there can be a quiet underneath that as well.
Some spiritual traditions reference the concept of oneness, sort of anatta by virtue of all selves. What does Theravada Buddhism say about this? The Buddha describes the experience of oneness or unity as a refined state of consciousness that still has us identifying with oneness, so that is still something to be relinquished and let go of, and to be able to turn to the relinquishment of self, that sense of even the I and me and mine that experiences oneness is still something to be relinquished. Could you expand upon the causes necessary to enter the stream? Is it simply a question of amassing these causes and the experience of the eventual fruit? Or does the practitioner also need to, quote-unquote, get in shape like an athlete preparing for an event who must be in top form? If the latter simile applies, does the yogi need to give it his all, or does he merely need to just hang in there long enough for the cause to bear fruit with just the right amount of dynamic tension? Well, sort of all of the above, and none of the above, in the sense that there does need to be these causes, or is the spoke the other day of the four factors of stream entry. There's also a discourse where the Buddha speaks of the path of, what's the path of stream entry? Factors, another sort of take on the factors of stream entry, and it's just sort of eightfold path, right view, right. It's just is a reiteration of the path, so that there's many factors that need to be come into balance. It does take. It's not just a passive accumulating of the right amount, so that one finally tips the scales, but it's like a discerning application of those causes. It's like if you're splitting wood with an axe, and you bring the axe up, and you've got a stump of wood, and you want to split it for firewood, and you hit that stump, and then you get up, and then you hit it again in another spot, and then you hit it again in another spot, and you hit it again over there, and then you hit it again over. I mean, you're sort of, you got the pieces in, you've got the stump, and you got the axe, and you got the person, but it's sort of not quite hitting in the right spot. So it's also having that, and then being able to hit that in the right spot, and then it'll split. So that practice is like that, where there's all these factors that we bring together, but we also have to attend closely to that right application of the investigation and application of discernment, so that it does sort of crack the nut, so to speak. Dear teachers, I have deep gratitude for your generous guidance. My heart is beaming with the benefits of your offerings. What a beautiful feeling. Thanks. It is a happy Thanksgiving. I hope it is for you as well. Sadhu. What is the threefold bliss? That's in the sharing of blessings chant. That is the bliss on the human realm, heavenly bliss, and the bliss of Nibbana. Those are threefold bliss, taking the sort of that happiness and well-being on the human, worldly, mundane level, living in the world, and then on the the heavenly aspect, kind of a divine bliss, and then the bliss of freedom and liberation. In the past few years, I've used a narrow area near nostril as my meditation object, without much success in terms of calming the mind. Lately, I've been using the whole body as object. Is there a difference in depth between these two types of objects as ways to experience a breath? There's the difference is the ability of the mind to take interest, so that the success of the meditation and the depth of the experience will come from the degree of interest and willingness to engage in the object, so that if the focus is too narrow, too refined, and one can't really get engaged or interested, and but one can with sort of the whole body or some other aspect of the breath, which is a bit broader, there's going to be a deeper experience, because one's actually engaging and because of that, if one's able to engage, then one's able to sustain attention, and then the attention and mindfulness, awareness, gains momentum. So then that's where the depth of one's concentration will rise from that, rather than just the object. So that aspect of finding things that one can be interested, engaged in as a meditation object is really important. Because if one isn't able to arouse interest, or one's not willing to arouse interest, then one loses interest in the meditation, so that the mind drifts sort of what comes to mind is a kind of a spin on Patrick Henry. Give me apathy or give me whatever. You don't get much meditation going with that. underlines that the mind is quite tricky. When I notice conflict arise or aversion to another and responding emotionally, I look to the Dhamma and practice and see where to let go. Offer compassion, loving kindness to what's happening, and try to see the moment as impermanent. And we will all die. Then the mind and body settle a bit. I begin to think, why can't the other person do this before they become so dramatic? I'm trying. Why can't they? And suddenly I'm tense, and the mind comes back again to making a me again. It tricks me into this loop. To have to keep catching it, and finding Mara keeps finding ways in. Yet they keep practicing with faith, so that I mean, that's the main thing, is actually catching it and seeing it, and the mind is tricky. That's what Ajahn Chah, remember him saying one time, you know, the quickest way to enlightenment is just to look directly at the mind and just point your finger and say, liar. it's liar. You know, it's the liar. You know, this keeps sort of spinning this web of lies all the time. So that recognizing that, and also that, you know, when we, and it's important for us to keep taking responsibility for our own suffering and our own well-being, because if we externalize it and wait for other people to, you know, to practice. Practice Dhamma, practice wisdom, practice patience, practice loving kindness, and our well-being is dependent on them doing it first, then you're sunk. it really, really is up to us to keep returning to that, that taking of responsibility and learning. So it is. I think of the story that Ajahn Chah, or the image that Ajahn Chah gives of you know, looking at people, other people, and you know, why can't they be more fair? Why can't they be more reasonable? And he said it's like the you go into the village and of course in Thailand out in the villages then you've got animals running around, the ducks and chickens and then you see the ducks and the chickens and you start thinking of, you know, what, you know, these chickens, you know, they can really run good. They run fast. They're really quick on their feet. And these ducks, they just waddle. And, you know, what? Why can't they be more like the chickens? You know, and the chickens and the roosters in the morning, they, you know, they crow and they've got some sense of purpose, and they do it in the morning and it makes a decent sound, and those ducks, and they just go quack quack quack. Why aren't those chickens, why aren't those ducks more like the chickens? You say, and that's where, you know, we spend so much of our time, you know, thinking about other people and other situations and the world around us, and it's just like, yeah, well, you know, trying to make ducks into chickens, and it's just is absurd. Okay. Whenever I trim my nose hairs, I'll be envisioning goblins and monastics from now on. That's great. Ajahn Chah mentioned know the mind within the mind. Is it just as effective to share Dhamma with a person who is actively dying, but the person is in a state of mental confusion or simply unconscious? Would their quote-unquote mind hear the Dhamma? Please share your experience. Thank you. Well, one of the things in terms of sharing Dhamma is it doesn't necessarily have to be an articulation of the articles of the teachings, in the sense of explaining somebody who is dying. And who is confused or maybe unconscious, sitting and explaining the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and three characteristics of existence, and that might not be the most effective way to share Dhamma, but to be present for that person in a way that is kind, is considerate, is attentive to their needs, is solicitous for their well-being. That's sharing Dhamma, and to be able to calm them, soothe them in ways that don't necessarily, you don't need to even speak, but that's sharing Dhamma. If we consider Dhamma being truth or something that is of an ultimate value, so that a kindness and attention, especially when somebody is dying, to just be present with that person, to be willing to be a calm and friendly and kind of warm presence with that person. That's really important. As we're dying, then sometimes there may be that mental confusion, or might not be conscious or seemingly conscious, but the actual presence of calmness or an anchor of well-being and awareness has a big effect. And sometimes it was just like that sharing Dhamma. Was it the story that Ram Dass tells of himself when his mother was dying, and he was kind of, he'd been a spiritual teacher for some time, and then he's presented with his mother dying, and he's trying to do the right thing get her to be with her breath, be present, so he's talking her through it, and trying to remember his actual name. Anyway, she didn't call him Ram Dass. Richard, yeah, sort of You know, she's laying there and say, you know, "Richard, be quiet." It's those attempts to share dhammas, quote unquote. So being a calm and steady presence for somebody who's dying is very valued. Also, sometimes, say as monks, oftentimes what we'll do is chanting when somebody is dying, when they're very ill. And there's something, I think, quite, especially if people are Buddhist or somewhat familiar, that the chanting can be very very soothing, very very settling, because it's it does bring one back to the just that recollections of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, recollections of the teachings. And and sometimes somebody who has even been seemingly mental confusion. There's something about the process of dying that cuts through that at the end. That's where it's even more important to be really present for that person, and it's a real gift. Would you expand on the concepts of Hiri and Otapa, which the Buddha called the protectors of the world? So this is an aspect of conduct or mental attitude that in terms of in relationship to conduct. And Hiri, trying to remember how Ajahn Jeff translates it.
Does he use conscience? Or?
Conscience and concern. Yeah, conscience and concern. And he's kind of thought long and hard how to try to get this into the English language in a way that comes across, because the early translators translated it somewhat literally as shame and moral dread.
Fear and shame.
Fear and shame, yeah. So that, those are loaded. One of the things that's important to immediately bring to mind is that Hiri and Otapa, as the Buddha said, these are protectors of the world, and they are the characteristic of the kusala jitta, in the sense that the mind is in a wholesome state, so that this isn't that kind of fear and shame and dread and moral dread and shame is because those immediately associate with kind of unwholesome mental states, agitation, worry, and But and it's important to recognize that the roots of what it means is that in terms of actions of body, speech, and mind, that one has a restraining influence, so that there is a conscience and concern, and the sense of conscience, hiri, is predicated on a sense of respect for oneself, so that because one respects oneself, one doesn't want one's actions of body, speech, or mind to go towards that which is harmful, negative, creating suffering or difficulty for oneself or for others. But particularly in the sense of conscience, in that one doesn't want to kind of stain one's own mind and conduct with something that is inappropriate, unnecessary, and then the otapa is its foundation is on respect for others. And because one has respect for others and one recognizes that according to the natural law of cause and effect, whatever we do, whatever actions we do, for good or for ill, of that we will... It has an effect, and we'll be the heirs. They have to receive the fruits of those actions. So that anything that is harmful to others, then there's a restraining influence in the mind. It's based on a sort of respect for oneself and respect for others. So that kind of leads one to a place of virtue, integrity, and a harmlessness that is very natural. So that attentiveness to hiri and otapa is a quality of investigation and something that we try to arouse or aspire to in a good way. Also, in the sense of hiri and otapa, because it's a wholesome mental state, its result is always happiness and well-being. So that's important too. So in the structure of the Buddha's teachings, when something is wholesome and kusala, then it's always associated with well-being and clarity. Would you please explain bhavanamaya panya? What exactly is it? And bhavanamaya panya is wisdom that panya being wisdom or discernment based on practice or development and. There's and this is a commentarial classification, which is, I mean, it's a good enough classification, in that they speak of suttamaya panya, jintamaya panya, bhavanamaya panya. So suttamaya panya is, wisdom that is based on sutta is hearing, so that being having heard. So it's like received knowledge, wisdom based on, or discernment based on received knowledge, having heard. Jintamaya panya is jinta is sort of like the ability of the mind to think, and so that it is the say the discernment based on an intellectual and rational analysis of things, being able to logically figure something out. And then bhavanamaya panya is the wisdom based on practice, development, training. In it. So it's bhavanamaya panya is considered the deeper, more reliable wisdom. And then, does it only happen when we're at least a sotapanna, or can it happen to a patujana, where that's somebody who is still unenlightened? I don't actually know. I don't know in terms of the classifications it's a visuddhimagga kind of classification explanation. Totally off the top of my head, with no backup at all, I would think that's a valid way to investigate our own discernment, understanding, wisdom, even on a worldly or still unenlightened level, but recognizing that it's taking us to a place of deeper understanding. Does it only happen in one mind moment and may happen again? Well, everything only happens in one mind moment. And so that sometimes you get a few of them strung together, and then may happen again. Yes, they definitely. Or does it stay with you once it happens? There's always a residue of, especially when we speak of sort of insight. There's a real change that takes place when we see something clearly. It may not be able to be articulated, may not be able to. So it does stay with us. That being said, I mean, even wisdom, discernment are impermanent phenomena that you have to look after. You have to attend to. That's part of the part of bhavana, in this sense of having to. Being willing and interested to look after our understanding and our mindfulness. So that's all today, which is not so many questions. Maybe people are. There's seems to be a lot of gratitude and settling down. So it's very, very nice. I once asked, there was a person who, Ajahn Chah taught a retreat at IMS in 1979. And he... That's his one visit to America, and there's a person, a Canadian guy who I know, who was on that retreat, and I think it was when I came to America already. It might have even been when I had to around. I think around the time I was doing my green card, I was 1999 or 2000. But anyway, I asked him if he had any memories of what stuck in his mind from that retreat. And he said, and he sort of thought for a minute, there's one thing he said. After Ajahn Chah had been at IMS for quite a few days already, and at teaching the retreat, and he came down and sort of he said I'm feeling like a bit like a kind of like a prisoner here, and sort of like, you know, people, you know, take me upstairs to stay, and then they bring me down from time to time for questioning. and then he also said, and there was another occasion after he'd been there for quite a few days and teaching, and Ajahn Chah's it can be incredibly charming and charismatic. But after the teaching one day, then he was getting up to go out, and he's walking out kind of slowly and just about ready to go, and then he turned around and sort of said to people, "I'm getting old and my knees hurt." Which was this person sort of said, he thought, found it really inspiring that you'd see on one level it was a very mundane statement, but just the fact that he'd been inspiring people and bringing energy to them, but then also coming back to just the realities of the body and the human condition. So we can have a short break and come back for puja.